Who is it?
If you enjoy...
Who's there?
...being really scared... If you're not afraid of the unknown, if you've found a friend in fear, then we have a friend for you.
Hi.
Samantha.
Come in, the police.
The director who unleashed Freddy in Nightmare on Elm Street, Wes Craven, now brings you his most frightening creation.
Get out of my house!
Hey, girl.
She's killing people.
Mom?
Sam?
Sam.
You're so cute.
Deadly friend. She can't live without you.
I am from beyond. Listen, and all you desire will be yours. Welcome to Spider-Man and the Secret Wars. Prepare for battle.
Shockphobia Fest.
Welcome to Prattle World. I am your host, the ever amazing, ever spectacular Spider Dan. And in this podcast, I spotlight entertainment's best kept secrets that a mainstream audience may find boring. And welcome to Shockphobia Fest, a month-long celebration of All Hallows Eve's most frightening films and comic spooks. And she's back from Shockphobia Fest last year. She returns from the grave. And she is going to tell us about a film almost 40 years ago about a man who warned us about the trouble of interfering studio executives and the dangers of AI. It's Tonya Todd. Welcome back to the show. On your own this time as well.
Yes, it's Noria this time, but that's okay. We didn't need to make her sit through this film, did we?
Well, you made me sit through it. So, but you've got things.
Oh, you have seen worse movies than this, so I don't feel badly about that at all.
No, you're right. I mean, you know, Mike suggested some poor ones, and I've suggested poor ones for other podcasts, and
I've subjected your guests to way worse than this movie.
Yeah, definitely, 100%. I cannot disagree with you. But yes, I wasn't sure if you wanted to maybe defend this one, or maybe you just want to kind of put spotlights on it. I leave that.
Depends
up to
on
you.
What you have to say. I mean, if it requires defense, then I will defend it. If what you're saying is fair, I will.
We'll see. I think there are some criticisms. I think that from ourselves, I'm sure. But there's still things I think within this somewhere that I quite like, and some of the ideas. If you are interested in hearing about more of Wes Craven, earlier this year, me and Dan Burgess covered one of his later films that he wrote and directed, My Soul to Take. If anybody's interested in going a kind of a deep dive on his career and the way he directs and stuff. So this will be like a mini version of that. I know that you don't like to do synopses. So should I take the reins on this?
Of course. And I say thank you for this.
That's all right. It's all right. I appreciate it. I don't want to put you out at all. But we're going to be talking about 1986's Deadly Friend, which I guess is kind of a Halloween movie. It's partially set on Halloween, but arguably it's more kind of a Thanksgiving film in a way. Probably more time spent just after Thanksgiving and the few days afterwards. But it is a story about a young man, a brilliant young man, who is a... I guess he's kind of like an MIT, like super brain, and he is studying. He's going to Polytech. He's moving. Him and his mom are moving to. He's going to study brain surgery. I think. But also, he's not too bad at the old robotics. He's built his own robot, very 80s style robot, who is very strong and a little headstrong at times as well, has his own personality, has his own advanced AI. He's learning, growing, advancing. And we meet, as they move in, we meet his friend Tom, and we meet Sam, the beautiful young Christy Swanson character, who she would go on to become the very first Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And he meets her, falls in love with her, Paul, the lead character. And unfortunately, she has a very abusive father, sadly, very kind of stereotypically abusive. And unfortunately, he accidentally, or well, I guess it is an accident to a degree, but it is still his fault, the death that had occurred. And she dies, and Paul is heartbroken, and also Bibi is destroyed by an angry neighbor with a shotgun during Halloween. And what Paul decides to do in his grief about losing both his best friend, the robot, and both Sam, the love of his life at 16, he decides to raise them both from the dead by combining them, and puts BB's computer brain inside Sam's no longer alive body. And then chaos ensues in so many graphic ways. But I
just sound so much deeper and high complex than it is.
There's a lot of depth. Well, I'm going to leave you to go into the depth of it, but I'm just going, this is the bare bones. This is the robotic skeleton of this film. So, please tell me why you wanted to talk about this on Halloween. What is this film? What's your history of this film? What does it mean to you?
I feel like we were having a conversation about films most people don't know. And I brought this up as one that I just remember enjoying. I didn't know that it was Wes Craven, so that was just a bonus. And I enjoyed the parts after Paul has his moment of arrogant brilliance. The parts before that, you know, the pacing is a tiny bit slow for those. At the same time, it feels underdeveloped, so that doesn't make any sense at all. Like, how is this the love of his life? It's like the only girl you've ever had in your life. That's how it really felt. A girl actually talked to me. I moved to a new town and a girl talked to me. Thus, I love her.
Quite literally, the girl next door.
Yes.
Oh, dear. And again, they kind of just randomly meet, like, oh, hello. And it's very teenage, like, oh, my name is Samantha. My name is Sam. Samantha. And my name, and what's your name? Paul.
Right. It was very clear. I've never spoken to a girl. I don't know what to do. He was so awkward in the things that he was saying. And for that to work, that shows you she's not allowed to talk to anybody. This is literally the first person that she came into contact with, and that's why she was spending time with him.
Yeah, it's like, oh, you're being nice to me. Because like Tom, he says all the girls around here are really stuck up or self-interested. And then he's like, oh, but Sam. And then he quite misogynistically says, oh, yeah, what's she like? What's she like? He goes, great tits.
Yeah, brilliant dialogue there.
Great. Yeah, unfortunately, that, again, it's just a sign of the times, I think. But I was just like,
she's like 16. Like,
yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. Christy Swanson was 16. I think they're playing kind of 16, I think.
It seemed like they were high schoolers.
Yeah.
Or high school age. I feel like Paul was brilliant and was attending college because of his brilliance, but he seemed like he was the same age.
Yeah, because Tom has that interaction where he's like, oh, are you in the same grade as me? Are you going to the high school? And he's like, no, I'm going to the university because I've got a scholarship. Or a
that whole interaction was just... That was not good acting.
No. I was going to say there's I feel like they're all really trying as well, like the actors, because they're young actors, you know, they're not that experienced. Like the actor who plays Paul was on Little House on the Prairie, so he'd had he had a little bit of fame, a little bit of practice, and, you know, honed his craft a little bit. But Christy Swanson, this was her first
gig. I thought she did a great job.
Yeah.
And now that you say that she was 16, then she really did a great job, because she had the toughest role, which is showing all of these multiple layers. She's meeting a boy. She's dealing with her father. Like, she has all of that trauma going on. She's falling in love for the first time. She dies. And then she has to play a robotic version of herself. And then the integration of herself and the robot version. Like, she didn't disappoint there. So I wasn't rolling my eyes at her acting. You could see that, oh, this girl is a step above what all the other people in this movie were.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And she's the one that's given kind of the most depth, the most kind of, you know, more of a character arc than most, I think. I think everybody else is kind of just like, oh, Paul happens to be super scientific and right. good at brain surgery and robotics, because we need the plot to do that. We need to get to the, you know, the robot zombie girl by the end. So we need those things. And like a lot of Tom's dialogue is like, it's very expositional. It's very like, oh, my dad has keys to get into the hospital whenever we like. Oh, that one, I'm sure that won't turn up later in the plot.
Exactly.
You know, and things like that. And oh, that's Sam and she does this. And this neighbor, she's crazy. And, you know, all that.
You can literally see the plot points, you know, as you're watching, it's like, check, check, check.
However,
so many movies now don't give you that. And you're just, what is happening right now?
Yeah.
They haven't even, at least it laid the groundwork.
Even if it
was clumsy in the delivery, even if it was, okay, we are seeing it happen, at least they did it. Because too often movies skip that part because of trying to be all clever. And then you're all, this is a hole. This doesn't make any sense. How did they just happen to get into this building?
It's the whole, somehow Emperor Palpatine has returned.
Right.
You know, it's that whole
just
thing.
Magically.
You're like, oh, he's just back. He sent out a message that was on a Fortnite video game that nobody heard, you know.
You're trying to trigger Mike.
a little bit. If he's listening, I hope he's listening. but yeah, no, I agree. I also think sometimes even modern films, they'll over explain still, or dumb things down, or like when actually you can trust your audience just to be intelligent and get it.
Right.
So I think there's still a lot of that going on, and a lot of studio interference. Like Wes Craven wasn't in a good place when this was made. So I feel pretty bad for him.
Was this before or after Nightmare on Elm Street?
It's definitely after. I mean, look at everything that is in this.
There's so much stuff. It looks like it could have been a precursor to it. Like, okay.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point.
This is an early movie that I finally get to make, but I don't have the budget to do all the stuff I really want to do.
Mm, yeah, no, I can see what you mean.
It looks like the same house. There are shots that look like they are taken right out of that movie. So I was wondering, is this the movie he got to do first? And once he did this, they're like, all right, we'll trust you with a bigger budget and you can do the movie you really want to make. They had the burning in the boiler room.
I was about to say, yeah, you've got the multiple dream sequences, the scary dream.
All the horror dream sequences, all the nightmares. It felt like it was a practice run for Nightmare on Elm Street. So for this to come afterward, like it seems like you're saying, well, what is going on? Like, why is this happening?
So Wes Craven, for people who don't know, he never really wanted to do horror films. Like, it was not his interest. He liked romances and, you know, dramas and things that were a bit more kind of on that level, the kind of indie dramas and things like that. And
relationships,
yeah, emotionals or talkies, I think, as Mike calls them, those type of movies. And he never really wanted to do horror, but, you know, one of his horror films took off, and then he did another one that took off. And
so
then
you get pigeonholed.
Yeah, and that's what happened to his entire career, unfortunately. He did make a film with Meryl Streep called Music of the Heart, which is about this this teacher who goes to, like, you know, a poor school or poor area and schooling, and she goes and she teaches the kids music, and then they put on a performance. And it was a big, like, Weinstein production. It was Oscar nominated as well.
Savior movies.
Yeah. White savior teacher goes into the whatever and saves all the kids and that. So it was that type of thing. So he did eventually do one of those, but throughout his career, he wanted to do different stuff, and he never. This was the one where he was like, "I think I'm going to make this kind of love story, this Frankensteinian love story going on."
So much Dr. Frankenstein groundwork going on with Paul.
This is
his origin story.
This is where it all begins.
Right.
But yeah, so he came. He was coming into this film. So it's based on a book. So he got the rights to the book, and he was like, "I want to make this film." And he was told that he needed to do a film with a bigger production company because New Line was very small. New Line is called the house that Freddy built because it was tiny until Nightmare on Elm Street took off, and then they were like full steam on all the sequels. And that kind of feeds into this story as well. So he wanted to do something different, something similar, kind of, you know, suburban horror story, but this gothic kind of love story, but modernized with robotics and kind of, you know, regular teenage kids. Wanted to explore those kind of abusive parents because he had an abusive parent and he grew up in this Baptist commune. So they were very kind of fundamentalist as well. Mm-hmm. So he found he didn't like that in his youth. And in that, you can see that in a lot of his films where the caregivers and the people in power, positions of power, are abusing that power,
neglectful. We're just trying to ignore all this stuff that the teenagers are telling us. They don't know what they're doing. They're just teenagers. Let's go back to our lives and ignore this problem while they die.
You see that in Scream, the useless police and the reporters, and then you see that in Nightmare on Elm Street, Nancy's dad's, you know, a cop, and then they killed Freddy, the parents caused the problem, her mum's a drunk, you know, all of this is very layered in his work. But he's also got a kind of a dark sense of humor, which I think comes through in this as well. But he found himself kind of going, right, let's do this idea, go to a big studio. And they were like, yeah, excellent. Yeah, we know your name. Great. You know, Nightmare's taken off. And so he does that. But at this point in his career, he was pulled from Beetlejuice, pulled from Superman 4. He was going through a very rough divorce. He described his marriage at that point as he found out that it was a sham. And then the cherry on the cake was that his script for Nightmare on Elm Street was being challenged because somebody else had written that story and he was riffing on it. So a New Line didn't defend or help Craven. They were like, you wrote the script, that's you. If you get sued for it, it's nothing to do with us. So they threw him to the wolves in some
ways. Oh, wow.
And what happened on this film is it started...
Can't say I'm sorry he didn't do Beetlejuice.
Yeah. I mean, it would have been a very different film. I don't think necessarily... It wouldn't have been the same film, but I think it would have been different, definitely. But, you know, we love Tim Burton anyway, so I'm not going to steal any of his credit at all. But, yeah. So he goes into this film and he's like, right, this is going to be more of a teen drama. You know, there's a lot of love going on and family dynamics.
He thinks he's John Green, and it turns out, no.
So he likes the macabre element, likes the, you know, all that sort of stuff. But he doesn't want to go, like, full gory horror and all that stuff, because that's what he's avoiding. He's like, I don't want... He told the lead actor who played Paul, he was like, I don't want to make a horror film. I don't want to make a gory horror film. And then the studio saw the success of Nightmare and went, we need you to do a gory horror film.
Yeah, because there's some gore in this. It's not Nightmare level gore, but they have some moments.
There's people in the beds, there's burnt men, there's, you know, stabbing, there's blood gushing everywhere.
Right.
And I think, unfortunately, because they did do a screening, it didn't go down so well. And then, which is, again, something we talked about in My Soul to Take as well. They go, right, we need to, let's put some gore scenes in here. Let's do this. I think what he was attempting to do was create something a little on the same lines as Starman, John Carpenter's Starman, which is kind of this sci-fi love story with Jeff Bridges. And that's what inspired him. And he wanted to try and do that, but with this, with a kind of macabre sci-fi edge. And the studios just didn't want it. And unfortunately, he'd filmed the majority of it, pretty much completely reshot everything towards the end of the film. And he went, no, we want you to write in these gore scenes. We want this to happen, this to happen, this to happen. This is going to be ending. The tacked on ending is not Wes Craven's ending.
That's the worst part, don't you think?
Yeah.
I decided I'm writing that off as another nightmare, because they had nightmares all through the entire thing. That did not feel like something that really happened.
Yeah, I'm with that.
It doesn't make any sense. There's no robot inside of her. There was a chip.
Yeah, it's a chip. But that's also like, where does she get her strength from? Where does she get this?
Yes, that makes no sense. Like, it would be her body with just the robot chip.
Exactly. And also, I was reading some of the differences between this and the book. And again, they went through several titles for this. Initially, it was Friend, like the book, and then it was AI, and then it was Artificial Intelligence, and then they changed it to Deadly Friend. AI is a Spielberg film I hate, by the way. But I won't get into that right now. But Yeah. So, and then at the end,
sounds boring though. Deadly Friends sounds interesting. It's intriguing. It makes you want to watch it.
Yeah, exactly. And he had a film called
Deadly. I'm wearing my Punisher shirt today because, hey, that would be a deadly friend.
and yeah, he had a film called Deadly Blessing. So maybe that was his idea. Put deadly in front of that as well. That's not one of his best either, but it's interesting what they're exploring there as well in regards to like religion and communes and things. But yeah, that is basically the story of how this film got made and how it became this schizophrenic horror film. Like, we've got this kind of, there's a lot of the kind of character building stuff was cut and it was replaced with.
Well, that makes more sense about why it seemed like, okay, this seems like a behaving as though they have really developed this relationship where we have not seen that happen on screen. How is she magically having Thanksgiving dinner with them when she's not even allowed to leave the house? Like, this is a little, what, wasn't that like the second time she came over, you know?
I mean, in the film, yes, I think so. But I think there was a lot more scenes with the mother as well and Sam. And I think the mother discovers Sam in her new form. And yeah, there's a few more interactions and a bit more from some of the kind of supporting roles. But yeah, so that's why we get this film. So I can kind of forgive it for that. It also, big surprise, didn't do very well box office wise. So it's kind of been buried. And I think that original cut is a lost as well. I don't think we'll ever see what that original cut was like.
It doesn't really feel like something that was ever put out in a theater. Doesn't it feel like a straight to...
direct to video or whatever they called it. Yeah. Back in the day, or VHS, straight to VHS. I guess it'd be straight to streaming now or whatever you call it. There is that. So when you revisited this film, you said you hadn't seen it for a while or?
Oh, not for a very long time.
Coming back to it, and again, you had fond memories of it. What was it like re-experiencing it?
Well, now I am a writer and a screenwriter and an actor. All of my viewing experiences with this were before that. So you're watching it and you're like, okay, I see the beats that they're trying to hit. It's like they're cutting it to make sure it hits these beats at the specific times rather than developing things. So there is a lesson there. So you see, hey, look, this is textbook. This part happens here. This part happens here. They did a really good job of developing villains that we don't mind seeing killed. They made this a revenge tale, essentially, with a tragic ending. So I enjoyed dissecting it from that perspective. And I still didn't hate it. And I enjoyed all of the kills. All of her kills, I should say. I didn't enjoy that she died. I didn't enjoy watching the robot die. Because that robot reminded me of Johnny Five, like an aggressive Johnny Five. Did you ever see Short Circuit?
Of course I saw Short Circuit. Yeah, I love Short Circuit. minus one character and the actor playing that one character shouldn't have been playing. But yeah, look, Short Circuit.
He dated Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yes. Yeah,
so you can hate him even more.
yeah, can do now. Yeah,
I had a crush on him in some other movie. I think some science movie, some terrible science movie.
Was it Hackers?
No, it was something else.
He's like the villain in Hackers, I remember.
No, he wasn't a villain in this. He was like the Jughead style friend.
Ah, okay.
I just remember he was.
Was it The Burning? He's in like a slasher movie called The Burning. No,
I don't remember what it was, but I know that science was in the title.
Right, got it. Well, we don't have that kind of time, Tonya, I'm afraid.
Fisher Stevens, science. Go.
Go. Tell us. Let us know. I could look it up now, but I can't be bothered.
This is why we need Rhea, because she would be looking it up. Mike would do the same, where I'm just like, yeah, I'm talking to Dan. I'm not doing it right now.
Now I don't know if this is true, but I did read on the IMDb that Johnny Five was actually used as a robot in this.
So it was the same robot. I feel like his face was very similar.
Yeah.
But there wasn't that.
The elevation, height, I think. Like would, his height. Yeah.
He would lift. So maybe it was a prototype for Johnny Five. I don't even know when this movie was made.
So I'm guessing 1985, 84, I think.
Maybe and then when was...
It came out in 86. Short Circuit came out in 86 as well. I don't know if it was by the same studio. Again, like, people can add to IMDb, so I don't know how accurate that is. But they both came out around about the same time. What did you think to...
I didn't like the voice.
Yeah.
It reminded me of the evil gremlins. Not of Gizmo, but the...
Yeah, the gremlins, yeah. Like Stripe and all of them, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, he's like, beep, 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 ah. Do you know who provided the voice for BB?
I forgot to check to see if it was the same voice as the gremlins.
Not sure about the gremlins, but it's Charles Fleischer, who was in Nightmare on Elm Street.
Oh, Roger Rabbit?
Yeah, Roger Rabbit, exactly. Yeah, that's him. So he provided that voice. I thought it might be Frank Welker, who is like Megatron and Scooby-Doo and Fred and all those kind of cartoon characters. I thought it might be him because he tends to do a lot of voices. He was like Abu in Aladdin and various other animals and stuff. Mm. So I thought it might be him since he's done robots and animals. It kind of is somewhere in the middle, that voice. But the thing I have a problem with is Paul is this advanced. He's doing brain surgery at uni, at university, even at his young age. He can create a microchip. He can create advanced AI. He can, reanimate dead people, but he can't teach a robot how to speak with a normal voice.
Right.
Is that his way of maybe being superior? Like, I'm just going to give you this insane, annoying voice. Like, and then I can always be like, yeah, you idiot, BB, you're rubbish.
So he feels superior.
I mean, if he's a Dr. Frankenstein, it wouldn't surprise me. Now we see like BB displays his strength and like in the opening scene, we see he can be quite violent and aggressive in his little mm-hmm. Terminator vision.
And protective.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Very protective. And
it's not like he's going around targeting good people.
No. No, he doesn't kill any innocent people. There's your stereotypical 80s bullies that turn up on some motorbikes.
Oh my gosh, that was the worst acting in the entire movie. Dude.
Yeah, it was not great. Like, hey, has anybody got a can opener? I was just like, oh, fucking hell. Are we doing this again? Like, it's like, I feel again, like you said, it's the writers are ticking the box.
Yeah. Right. Bullies check.
Stereotypical bully, stereotypical drunk, abusive father, stereotypical angry, paranoid neighbor. Tick, tick, tick,
And only one of them spoke, I think, just the leader who did not seem very tough at all. Like, how is this the guy in charge? The other people just stand around in sunglasses and flannels. Oh, yeah, you guys totally look like legit bikers. You're terrifying.
I think Wes Craven might have seen Back to the Future the year before. So Biff says all the stuff, and then they've got all the guys in the background, Billy Zane and everyone wearing sunglasses. Yeah. Like, yeah, do. Like that kind of bully, like, just repeating what they're saying. Yeah, you're stupid. Yeah, you're stupid. All that sort of garbage. But did you know that the robot they built for BB was actually quite strong, like BB in the film? It could lift and like hold, I think it was like 750 pounds.
So they put all their authenticity into the robot and not into the actors.
The robot's very believable and I did, like, to be fair, like you said, like when the robot gets destroyed, you do feel something for that robot. Like,
oh my gosh, they just killed a character.
Yeah. And again, he's protecting them, he's going to attack, and again, it's like the whole like got the arms up doing the thing, and you're kind of like, and she's like, she doesn't give a fuck. It's like my house, my rules.
She enjoyed it.
And it was the thing as well, like when they like Paul blames Tom, he's like, you're responsible for BB being destroyed. And I'm like, he's not.
It was his call for them to be messing with the old lady's house, but ultimately you guys all chose to be there and it's your robot.
And Paul said, yes, go ahead. Then Sam ran in once the door was unlocked. She set off the alarm. And then for some reason, she's acting like she's never heard an alarm in her life.
Right. She's screaming like she's an alien or something. What is this sound? That's not how you respond. You get the hell out of there.
Yeah. It's just like, woo, woo. It was just like a standard alarm. It wasn't like...
Then she's classic blonde girl, trips over her own feet, running away from the bad guy. It's like, oh, honey, you deserve to die at this point.
Right away. I don't even know what she's dressed as either. Like, there's no like...
Like an Athenian, I think, is what they were trying to make her.
Yeah. I can't even remember what Tom's costume was. And then Paul is so dull. He's just coming out in a Polytechnic hoodie. Like, that's his costume.
He went as himself.
Even BB had a costume.
Vandalizing people's cars with the robot. Like, oh, I wonder who did this.
It's probably, and the robot has its own costume as well. Paul doesn't.
Right.
It's got a little
better
hat.
Than Paul's.
Yeah. At least he's trying to disguise himself. At least he's giving it a go.
And I seem a little old to be doing that kind of stuff. Like, especially if you are so intelligent that you're going to university, you're probably too mature to be, what were they, like putting shaving cream on cars and stuff? Like, come on, dude.
Is that even like a Halloween prank? I thought it'd be like egging houses and you know, the toilet paper.
It's the thing that people do, but usually younger.
It was a bit odd. I didn't really understand that.
Give me the description of the people who, you know, like right in front of the person. It wasn't even like they were doing it secretly. It's right in front of the driver. Give me the description of the people who vandalized your car. Well, it was a girl dressed like this, two guys, and a robot.
A robot. Yeah, I don't see many robots around here.
Nothing we can do.
All right, complete disguise.
I don't want to match that description.
Complete disguise. Did you enjoy the 11 miles right at the beginning of the film? The quickest 11 miles you've ever seen in your life. Did you notice that at the beginning?
I noticed that it was 11 miles.
So in the beginning, we see like someone tries to break in the car and BB attacks the intruder.
Right.
And then the mom and Paul get back in the car and they start driving. And then the next scene, it's during the day. Paul's looking at the map and his mom's like, how far is it? And he's like, oh, don't worry. We've got another 11 miles. And she's like, how do you know it's 11 miles? You've not brought your head up from the map. And he's like, I know, because I'm, oh, wait, turn here now.
Right there.
Yeah. I was like, Christ, that's a quick 11 miles.
Thought I must have misheard something and I didn't care enough to go back.
No, that's definitely happened. That definitely happened. He just goes, he goes, we got 11 miles until now, straight away. And then they're like, whoa.
Right. Well, what type of movie is this trying to be?
Well, I guess that's the problem deep down, isn't it? It's two halves, much like Sam and BB's brain. They're trying to kind of blend this Frankenstein's monster together, right. And it's just not there. It's just not.
Actually, it could have been a very beautiful, touching story if they had gone with that route.
When I was looking on IMDb, there's a list of differences between the film and the book, and the book ends on like an icy lake, and what happens is Sam, like, she's killed various people. She's killed the dad, she's killed the neighbor, Elvira. They're killed in slightly different ways in the book, but then at the end of the film, the police are chasing him and Sam, and then Sam looks like she's going to attack Paul, and he pushes her off this bridge into this icy lake. And then she was going to embrace him as, you know, as a lovely kind of caring thing, but he misinterprets that and throws her off. And then just as he realizes that, she falls into the lake, dying, and she screams after Paul and like, come with me. And then he's like, and I think he dives into the lake after her.
Oh, so very Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, exactly. Very kind of Frankenstein, because it's all in the kind of Arctic and stuff. So there's
right.
that. And I think he says something like, so this was love or something like that. So I don't know. Maybe there was definitely something there on the IMDb as well. It said that there is a remake in development.
Oh, I don't think they should remake it unless it's a completely different thing and they're just going with a different story.
I think this one's
entertaining on its own. I mean, if you look at it at its core, it's basically an undead love story where she has made him her familiar. I will kill, you'll clean up after me.
yeah, absolutely.
And you will take care of me and hide me from the world so that I don't have to be bothered with them. But I will protect you with my undead strength.
Yeah. What did you think to the drugging of the mum as well?
That was so irresponsible. Like, I can't believe you're going to do... And drugging her while she's drinking coffee, too. Like, that is not a thing you want to do. So you have opposing drugs in her system. What are you trying to do to your mother? So I'm glad they actually touched on, you could have killed her. Like, you're being very arrogant here, and you just made an assumption. It's kind of strange that Tom, who's not that bright, was the voice of wisdom in this entire story.
He was at every point.
Right. He's this pretty dummy, and girls don't talk to him. That kid was adorable, you know?
Yeah.
You know why they didn't talk to you? There were no girls. There were no other girls in the story except the girl next door who is locked in her home. Did she ever go to school? She's always talking about homework, but it seems like she never left her house except when her dad was asleep drunk.
I quite enjoyed the mum character, and I felt bad when they drugged her, because I was like, I don't think this is necessary, because I think she seems to let him go off and do his own thing, and,
right.
and he's dealing with Sam and teaching Sam how to, you know, clean up after her messes, like you were saying, all this while, and she has no idea. So I think he could easily have, you know, outsmarted her.
Or ways to sneak out without drugging your parents, just saying.
Well, and again, it was something they confronted. And I like when he's trying to like stir it in with his finger and he's like realizing it's like boiling hot. He's like, so bizarre. I have to tell you about the one joke that really made me laugh. The one joke that really got me. Again, it's got this kind of goofy kind of humor in it. It's kind of dark, slightly dark, sick edge of humor, especially when she's like, when the mum goes, I make damn good coffee, and like Tom's like does the spit
when
take
he spits out his milk or whatever he was drinking.
Yeah, that I found funny. But then the line that really got me is when, you know, the abusive dad has killed Sam, thrown her down the stairs, and she's brain dead, and Paul's come up with this idea of replacing her brain with BBs to, you know, revive her. And he's like, let me explain it to you, Tom. And it does a hard cut away from the outside of the house. And all you hear is, are you out of your fucking mind?
Yeah, that was funny.
that was like,
because he was perfect. The voice of reason.
Yes. Pitch perfect. Because that's what you would say, like, to this idea. You would say, are you out of your fucking mind?
This is when he showed up at his house, when he's like, do you know what time it is? And it's like super bright, like noon outside, but they show it's 6:30. Where is it that bright at 6:30 in the morning?
Nowhere.
In autumn. You know?
Good point. Oh, dear. Well, we've got to talk. You were talking about the kills earlier. We've got to talk about your favorite scene in the entire film. I think you need to describe this wonderful moment, because it's the one moment that I think if anybody's heard of Deadly Friend, they know this scene. So please tell us about.
And you posted something, or maybe you didn't post it. You found it. You found something that was like the enemy.
Oh, that was it. There's been recently like this this kind of theme going through Twitter, and it's like these two had beef. Like these two had, like, you know.
Is she the Where's the Beef lady?
No, that's not her. She's in the Goonies. Okay. She's the villain in the Goonies.
I know she's in the Goonies, but I didn't know if she was that Where's the Beef lady. Because
no, she's
a
little.
Does she have a similar kind of voice?
Yeah, it's kind of like Where's the Beef. She's not in this, but she is in a film called The Stuff. Where she plays the same role, but she, instead of saying "Where's the beef?" she says "Where's the stuff?" because it's this yogurt dessert that's alive. Yeah, basically. So I think it was actually this year. I think it was around this year that came
Mama
out.
Mama Fratelli, right? Isn't that?
Yeah, that's her. Yeah, Mama Fratelli, that's her in this.
So who doesn't want to see her have a basketball slammed through her face, man?
And then stumble all around like a headless chicken.
With the blood spurting everywhere.
Just going everywhere. I was watching a video, and Christy Swanson said that was her favorite scene. And if you watch, she was like, I'm trying so hard not to laugh during this scene because it's just utterly ridiculous. But if you watch closely, you can see her kind of breaking a little bit, like cracking
it's
a bit.
It's such
of a, smile.
A clever kill. And it seems like that's one of those reasons it feels like a precursor to the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, because, you know, were those great movies? Not necessarily. Like, the writing wasn't stellar, but there were all of these creative kill moments. That's why you watched it, so that you could see how are they going to kill people this time? Like, what creative method are they going to use? And basketball through the head that they set up because she stole their basketball. Hey, it's in my yard. No, you can't have it. You're going to be that nasty old lady who won't give back the basketball that accidentally went in your yard. Like, come on.
I mean, you're a writer, you know, Tonya. We've all heard of Chekhov's basketball.
Right.
It's bound to happen.
You know, they made it such a tense moment where the ball bounces in slow motion into her room. who's there? Who's there? It's the basketball. So if you actually cared about this woman, this would be terrifying. But no, you don't. And you want to see her die.
I saw a book recently, and it was like a top 100 book of most unique kills in films. I think it's called like Umbrella Through the Chest or something like that. I'll see if I can find it and link it below. But I guarantee Deadly Friend is in there. I guarantee it. 100% that is in there. That is in that book.
Yeah, I haven't seen it since. Have you?
No, I can't. I can't say I have. But yeah, I don't think you will maybe ever see it again unless they remake it. Maybe they'll have to, because I think in the book, and I think they did film another version of it where she drowns her in the bathtub.
Oh, that's far less entertaining. Yeah.
No, that's it. I'm misremembering. So in the book, it's in the bathtub. But in the film, she was slammed through the door, the front door, because she's always out.
Kind of like another Nightmare on Elm Street thing.
Yeah, kind
where
of.
Where the mom comes through the window.
Pulls her through, and she turns into the worst dummy you've ever seen in your life when he pulls her through.
These look like the same houses. I swear it's the same street.
But I guess, again, no, I think you're right. Like, again, obviously there was this added gore and these added dream sequences, and Craven likes dreams, and he did film these dream sequences, but they were forced in. The writer actually, he wrote, have you seen Jacob's Ladder?
I have not seen that. It is something I would very much like to see.
I think you'd really like Jacob's Ladder. He wrote the spec script for Jacob's Ladder. It didn't get made until the early 90s with Tim Robbins, but that got him the job to write this script and then another one, and it got him out of bankruptcy because he was... Hmm. I think there was another writer's strike around this time.
Was this back when they paid writers?
Yes. maybe just. But yeah, there is that. And he would go on to write many more things as well. But he loved working with Craven on this, and he didn't particularly like the rewrite. He didn't like the ending, especially because he was like, I can't say that's the producer's choice of ending because it's a shit idea, and I don't want to tell him it's a shit idea in case I lose my job. But it was, yeah. And I'm the same. I chalk that up to the dream logic. It's the whole Carrie thing, isn't it? I think it started with Carrie, that kind of shock horror ending. You have to do that, and Friday the 13th did it, and you know, many others, and even Nightmare on Elm Street does it as well. So I think it's just one of those tropes in horror.
But some of those are to create a sequel. This didn't feel like a sequel. It just felt like, now let's just throw in this kill that makes no sense because she loves him and BB loves him, so there's no reason for anybody inside there to hurt Paul. The whole thing was protecting Paul, except for the dad. That was protecting. Yeah. Like, that was the first one was from her. But everything was about protecting Paul and keeping Paul safe. So why would you kill Paul, who did everything to continue protecting you? Didn't it almost feel like he was bringing Tom up to the attic to get killed? Like, oh, you're going to tell?
Like, hey, look, here's your friend. You know, your friend.
Right. Yeah. I wasn't trusting him at that point. He seemed like he had gone off the deep end.
Mm. Well, I mean, he's gone round because he says, I'm going to tell the police. I'm going to tell everyone.
Right.
She's killing people.
Oh, just give me a half an hour. Oh, yeah. Famous last words.
Yeah. Well, I mean, she does almost kill him because she comes. He goes down. He's too scared to talk to her. Runs outside. And she leaps out the window and then strangles him like, and then he does survive, though. He does live. He's in a state, but he does live. And then they bump into the bully. And this is where it kind of lost me.
Paul runs after her.
Yes.
And doesn't worry about his friend who just nearly died.
Yeah. He's like, nah, it's fine.
Mom's got him.
Not worried about his mom or the police or anything like that.
Right.
Purely focused on Sam. And he bumps into this bully that he mostly takes care of by himself. And then Sam comes along, and she's kind of almost fully embracing the BB-ness in her now. And you know, and then and again, she does this massive, you know, incredible Hulk throw. And this guy's like, she must have thrown him 30 feet. You know, this really 80-yard thing in. I was just like, oh.
Which did not feel like 30 feet. And also, why the dramatic come around the corner? So if you knew that he was in trouble, why didn't you move faster than that?
And this is another thing. Like I'm all up for kind of stylized like movements and I think there's some really good shots, like close up shots where Christy Swanson is really imitating BB in his movements and his mm-hmm. with his hands and the way he moves and the neck and all that. But then
gradually getting more comfortable in the body.
Yes.
And becoming more and more human.
But I feel like all of a sudden when the stunt people are replacing Christy Swanson, that she's just like, I'm just going to run like a normal human now.
Right.
Like, it's not like a gradual thing. Like, it just feels like this.
It's only gradual when it's her.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. No, exactly. But that's the thing. By the end of the film, we're seeing that we'll call it the Terminator vision is dropping and that Sam is coming through. Like, the whole experiment worked, like, to a degree. You know, Sam is coming back, but at this point, it's too late because BB's gone around on a killing spree. Sam or BB or BB Sam, whatever. And that's the tragic aspect, is she sacrifices herself because she doesn't want to be this mixed up monster by the end of it, that she makes the policeman shoot her and she dies. One of my other issues with this as well is, like, I think it would have been, in some ways, I think it would have been better if she was still alive and then they put the chip in and brings her back and it's still... The fact that she's dead
for a long time.
Yeah, the fact that she was dead, and again, we're talking about this chip. It's only affecting the brain, right? So all of her other bodily functions have ceased to be.
Right.
So she doesn't seem to be eating. You know, what's that doing to her? You know, like, why is she not looking more emaciated? Why is she not rotting? Why, you know, why can she still?
Oh,
you know,
no, blue makeup.
Yeah, that's fine. That's it. That's it. That's all we need. Just dark rings around the eyes. That's fine. I think that's maybe why they make it such a short period of time, like just a few days.
So we don't see her skin falling off of her.
Yeah. Like, if you're going to give me gore, give me that. Like, if you're going to do the gore thing, do that. That would have been more interesting.
Still be pretty, or else who cares?
True. Can't have an unattractive love story.
Right.
That's not Hollywood. But yeah. And in the book as well, apparently that did happen. That's what started happening.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So in the book, that was one of the key differences. And that's why I was like, oh, shit, that would have been better if they'd shown that. But also Paul was like, apparently Paul had killed before, because someone was trying to like harm BB or get rid of BB in a previous school, and that was kind of why they had to move. But he was also overweight as well. Paul was an overweight kid in the...
Oh, well, you know, we can't have an overweight protagonist.
Can't do that. Again, can't have a zombie and a fat kid get together. Not happening. That's not interesting, is it?
You know what? Maybe they should redo this movie, but yeah, be more accurate to the book.
Maybe you should remake it.
I'm making another movie.
I know. You're the writer now, you're the actress, now you're making your directorial debut. So this is it. And now you know this film, you love the film, you know the holes in the film, you know the problems with the film. You're the one to fix it, Tonya.
I have to read the book first.
Fair enough. I think I might. I'm kind of interested, actually. I'd like to kind of look at that. I think we are slowly running out of time. Is there anything else you would like to say about the film? Was there any more holes you want to poke in it?
Oh, we covered the tragic acting and the good acting. We covered mm-hmm. the creativity of the kills, mm-hmm. the similarities between Nightmare on Elm Street and this movie, because come on, we're going to have the big, scary, abusive to children guy go yep. downstairs and be burned. Why didn't they just throw a hat on him, you know?
Exactly. It wasn't very well hidden, was it, I guess? But
no.
Yeah.
And it didn't feel like an homage. It felt lazy.
Lazy homage. Well, yeah, again, it's a ripoff. That's what it is. We've got Wes Craven ripping himself off.
Wasn't like, haha, you see what we did? It was like, yeah, just do this.
Yeah. That seems
the last one.
Again, Hollywood always learning the wrong lessons. Oh, this is popular. Let's just do this. Even though the story doesn't call for it in any way, shape, or form. Let's just do it.
No. Like, how did they even find the guy's body?
Yeah, they just kind of go, oh, we found them both in like a day.
Because he spent all that time covering it up. They showed him covering it up, and then when they find Elvira, like, two people are dead. How did you find out about the first one? And why is there no police investigation where you're going around to the neighbors and asking questions?
And also, these people are like recluses anyway. You've got Elvira's locked into a house. She's not getting out. No one's coming in. And
is
like,
anyone getting fingerprints? Don't you think they should be at least telling people there have been two murders in the last 2 days? Stay inside. Report any suspicious behavior.
there's no reason why anyone would go to that house or go in. Like, no one's coming to see the violent drunk who's killed his daughter, and everybody knows,
by the way, her body's missing, you know.
That seems to be the main concern, and no one's going over to Paul, who's, again, you know. What did you think of the whole heist, the body heist sequence, when they were going into the hospital and coming out? And
so unlikely. And her body wouldn't fold up into that thing. Like, if she's already dead, it would not be that they would be breaking her to force her into that.
And again, it would be heavier than that they're making it out to be as well.
Right.
Like, they're making it out like it's like, do. Oh, she's in there. Where's all the... And then he's like, the thing is, they were going up there to get a living person and fit her in that and put some sort of...
So they're
going to
make her do that alive?
Yeah. And then life support. Like, it makes more sense for them, and it's more tension building if they went out the front door, like they're disguised as doctors or morticians or you know, people who walk in the morgue, instead
having
of this
her
kind of
on a gurney, maybe, like, just what are you doing? Yeah.
Or in a like, get really macabre with it, just have her in a wheelchair, just like that, you know, just rolling through, and everyone's like, oh, you're looking so much better, or something like that. Like,
instead of having this laundry cart, they should have had the wheelchair waiting for them.
Exactly. That's what I think. And again, she's only just died, so she doesn't look like she's not rotting away. You could get away.
No, but she's not very flexible.
No, fair enough. She's definitely not. She's flexible enough to get in the wheelchair. She's not flexible enough to get in that, you know, whatever that thing is, the laundry holder or whatever it is. But yeah, I think that was when I absolutely kind of zoned out of the film for me. I was just like, this is supposed to be like really tension filled, but I just don't care.
There's no tension here.
Let's get to the zombie robot fun stuff at this point, because I think by that point, like you said, that first half is a bit like, it's very twee and very like, oh yes, this we have this wonderful life, and again, but then there's the sinister kind of like, oh, that bitch has moved my things. Why is she doing that? I hate her. I'm gonna kill her. You know. And again,
and
like,
what did his mom even do for a living? Like, so she is the secretary for the doctor who works with her son, and you live in this house on that, you know?
Apparently, the scholarship gets you a lot. Maybe he sold, I don't know if he sold like the blueprints of BB, or maybe he's made some other inventions. But again, that might have been in the cutting room.
I don't
floor.
Think so, though, because she's saying, take care of this camping gear that I provide all of this, and you just leave your sleeping bag outside. That's not okay. There, that could have been their excuse. We don't need to drug the mom. We could just say, we're going to be camping outside. We're going to camp in the backyard. It's something fun to do. We're not going to be out in the wilderness. We're just going to do it right here.
I do like, did like the moment where they were like, the mom wakes up after the drugging, because they're worried they've killed her, and he goes, what have you guys been up to? And they'd be like, we've been fooling around. We've been fooling around. And there's a little bit of that homoeroticism there I picked up on. I was like, there's a little bit of something there.
They had way more chemistry in that regard than Christy Swanson and the lead guy.
Yeah, that very like tepid kiss they have. Like, I don't profess to be a very good kisser myself, but I'm thinking I'm better than that. That was just like, it's like very, very tight-lipped, closed mouths, peck. Like, very
but
tense.
It was probably the first kiss for either one of them.
There is that. But I think if we're talking about those teenage boys, and we're talking about them saying, you know, Christy Swanson has great tits, I imagine he would just be more like, sticking the tongue out and trying to get that in straight away.
Well, that could just be a cover for we're homosexual and we want to sound straight.
Ah, good point. But yeah, I did quite enjoy it. It was like, we've been fooling around. Yeah, we have been fooling around. And the mum doesn't, like, I don't know if that was a phrase that was used in the 80s for meaning what I, you know, something sexual or romantic. But there was that that made me chuckle. Before we finish, Tonya, again, is there anything else you want to say about it, or would you recommend it?
I still think it's worth watching. I found it entertaining. I have more respect for Christy Swanson as an actress, especially if she was only 16 and delivering that well, and being screwed over by the studio. Do this. No, do it like this. No, change the story to this.
Yeah, I think the actors were kind of pulled from pillar to post a lot of the time, because again, they would shoot something, change it, rewrite it, and then again, it'll be cut. And, you know, will it make the final cut? They don't know. Just do what I say now and do it like this. And then
I think there's a reason we've only seen two of these actors in anything else.
Yeah, there's a reason. I think the lead did go on to do more kind of voice work and like video games and cartoons and stuff. The guy who plays Paul. But yeah, he never did another film after this.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. Again, according to IMDb. IMDb!
No, you did not have to.
So before we finish, I do have some listener comments. So I went round and asked if anybody had any memories or feelings about this. Again, it's a film that people haven't seen, really, I don't think. So what I did is I asked for suggestions for the deadliest friends in cinema history. So
you know what? There was one more thing before you get to that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
The music was just so classic horror 80s.
And I think it was just as schizophrenic as the film, because it would be like the tone for this film is all over the show. And I think
everything
the music
is fine and sunshine and sparkles, and then doom, yeah, for no reason.
And again, I think it's when they're coming into the driving into the you know the neighborhood, and you hear, oh, that dirty bitch, he moved my things. And then all you're hearing is this lovely, like, you know, this, like, right, this little ditty, this little nice kind of pleasant, you know, music going on. And you see, ah, that bitch, I'm going to slap her when she gets home. You know, it's just,
yeah,
like,
hilarious.
Yeah, it's very tone. And then you'd get that, again, very over the top comedic music. And it's not funny when they're playing that comedic music. The horror music is good when it's there. But it's again, it's kind of just, it's like, now, do it now when it's scary, instead of kind of building, or, you know, the peaks and troughs of that music that should happen.
Right. So let's get to listener comments.
Listener comments, yes. So John Hammond, who is, we've been talking about Nightmare on Elm Street and Trick or Treat and the similarities there. He says, Chucky, your friend till the end. And Dave Horrocks has suggested Pennywise. He just wants to be friends with you. He's got a balloon, you know. I suggested one as well, because I felt this was a good one. Hedy Carlson from Single White Female, I wanted to put out there, because she wants to be her best friend, wants to be just like her.
He does. I don't know. I think she crosses more into the danger to the actual friend.
Yeah, maybe. Not protective.
Right. Yeah.
And Dave has also said Pinhead, he likes his friends with benefits.
Meow. I like Pinhead.
Oh, there's a lot to talk about that in that franchise. And Blake suggested quite a few. He's gone for Mickey and Mallory from Natural Born Killers, the girls of Old Town from Sin City, Murtaugh and Riggs from Lethal Weapon, Baby Doll, Amber, Blondie, Rocket, Sweet Pea from Sucker Punch, and then Mike Lowry and Marcus Burnett from Bad Boys.
You know, I will say this was a better movie than Sucker Punch.
I couldn't agree with you more.
That should have been amazing. The costumes, the coloring, that should have been so fun. And I remember watching it with a friend, and as soon as it was over, he's like, get that shit out of my VCR. Or it wasn't a VCR, it was a DVD or something. I don't know what it was.
Before it infects everybody.
Whatever it was, he's like, get that out of my system. Like, just,
yes.
He was watching it for that. He wanted to watch it for the eye candy. And
Didn't we all?
Barely covered that.
I thought it was going to be quite this kind of feminist kind of, you know, they're going to say something about that.
It was so bad. But it introduced me to Oscar Isaac. It was the first time I ever saw him.
Mm. And
it made an impression on me.
He does have that creepy thin mustache. Not very creepy. A bit greasy.
I don't even remember it, because
probably for the best.
Remember this movie? It was so bad. I recommend this 100% above that.
Fair enough. Max Byrne has also said The Regulators from Young Guns. So the whole Billy Kid in the gang. Dave Horrocks again. Billy and Stuart from Scream, also a Wes Craven film.
And they are deadly friends.
They certainly are. And Mike has suggested Happy Death Day, but doesn't want to spoil the ending of that film.
I have not seen that.
Okay, well, I won't spoil it then. I certainly won't spoil it. It's a slasher, but it's kind of Groundhog Day at the same time. I think
I wonder if his answer spoils it anyway.
Maybe, perhaps. And he says, I was going to mention Scream, but Dave beat me to it. The guy Corey from Halloween Ends is another. Amy Dunn in Gone Girl and Norman Osborn in Harry.
Not really a friend to anybody.
Nah, to herself. To herself.
She was pretending to be friends.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't say she's a friend to anyone that... Yeah, nobody in that film.
However, one of the best movies that has been mentioned in the last 2 minutes.
Yes, true. Norman Osborn in Spider-Man, maybe, or even Harry Osborn. Harry Osborn,
I can see that. Yeah.
And then math, I've got two. I've got to be careful because it's a spoiler. So first, Terminator 2, they have to lower him into the molten lava at the end. And then have you seen The Mist?
I have not.
Okay, then I'll say no more. It's quite a big spoiler for that film.
Okay.
But
thank you for that.
Yeah, I think Chris Phelps wants to watch and hasn't seen it either. So he's tried to avoid spoilers for that. I do recommend it. I do think The Mist is very, very good. It may have even come up in my Stephen King top five, not sure. But anyway, time is running out. Tonya, you, again, like I said, are making your directorial debut very soon.
Well, I am directing a short film that is based on the first short story I ever had published. And this is the part that hurts me, because in order to crowdfund, you have to tell people what the movie is.
Yeah. Sorry.
I'm going to spoil my own movie, which is painful for me, you know, but it is appropriate that I'm doing it with Spoiler Dan.
Spoiler Dan, absolutely. I've not spoiled anything today apart from Deadly Friend.
Well, you know, you kind of say that when we're going to be talking about this movie.
Sure.
So what I'm doing is a short film where a vampire posing as a detective helps the woman he loves search for her missing husband. And to do this, we are crowdfunding. If you check out the really cool incentives, you'll find these amazing gifts that Dan put together that look really awesome, don't you think?
I do. They've come out really well. I wasn't sure how they'd kind of correspond or fit within the website. I didn't even know what type of crowdfunding website you were using, but yeah, they've turned out really well. And we
either found them or made them, and then eventually they were made to fit. It was a very frustrating process, but he is an unsung hero, my friends.
That's all right. I didn't mind. It was a fun little experiment for me. I learned some new skills, and it helped you. So it was all beneficial.
Well, I am eternally grateful to you. I could not have done this without you. So go check it out. It's called Morning Sacrifice. That's morning with a U, and it's on the seedandspark.com site. So if you just look up Morning Sacrifice, you should be able to find it. I'm guessing Dan's going to put it in the show notes as well. I don't know if it will be finished by the time this show comes out. I believe October 20th is when it
Yeah, I think it's 28 days as of now. So yeah, I think it'll probably be around the 20th, I think. Yeah, so this will probably, I think, actually, you know what, this could come out on the 20th. So we could kind of half promote it. I can move things around a bit.
And even if it has finished, you can still follow the project and watch how it develops.
Can you still donate as well afterwards if it has been fully funded, for example?
I really don't know. I haven't had that experience.
Right. Good. Well, there may be the
option. I know I won't turn down money.
Nobody should. So if it allows you to still donate, please do. There's lots of stuff. I've donated, and I'm looking forward to the benefit or
I'm a little worried about that. You're too excited about that. And I was nervous about putting that as an incentive. Like, what if I get some weirdo?
That's me.
Yeah. And you jumped on top of that and then are messaging me about muahaha. Guess what? I'm going to name one of your characters.
Well, you know, I might even ask for other people's suggestions. You know, obviously it's got to fit the theme. So, you know, Teethy McFang face, you know, something like that, maybe. I think that works. I think that will fit the, you know, the dark noir aspects and gothic horror you're going for. I'm sure it'll be fine. That'll fit. It, you know, your actors won't struggle saying those lines and names without laughing. I'm sure it'll be fine.
You're awful.
apart from that, Tonya, where can people find you on social media?
You can find me across social media at Ms. Tanya Todd. My website is MsTanyaTodd.com. I'm part of the Femme On Collective. You can find me on that podcast and across various podcasts in this, the Comics in Motion Network, including Mike Burton, lots of Spider-Dan shows, Rhea shows beforehand. We just have such a wonderful community, and we're all so supportive of each other, and I'm really grateful to be a part of it.
Yeah, me too. I'm very, very lucky, blessed even to for them to keep me around, the weird uncle of the podcast world.
Better than the creepy uncle.
Definitely not creepy. I'll die on that hill. Weird, but not creepy. Don't confuse the two. Never confuse the two. But yeah,
if you mind when you name my character, weird but not creepy.
Weird but not creepy. No, it won't be creepy. It won't be creepy. And if you want to find me, you can join the Pratalion and be briefed on in full on the Secret Boars. Swing over to Prattle World at www.spidermanthesecretboars.com. And don't forget to use the hashtag #PrepareForPrattle. Please subscribe to the Pop Culture Collective newsletter to find out what myself, Comics in Motion, Femme On Collective, and all the other related podcasts are up to week by week. I'd also like to thank my patrons on Patreon. I am Jax Musing, Simon Cotton, Paul Meller, Max Byrne, Mike Burton, Angry Andy, Tonya Todd, Tony Farina, Math, Scott Hodgson, and now Rhea Carrigan as well. Thank you for your...
It's growing.
It is. It's larger than I could have even dreamed or imagined just a few years ago when I put that out. But thank you very much for your continuing donations. It is very much appreciated and helps Prattle World keep on turning. And if you ever find yourself in a position to help the podcast, please consider it. Well, Tonya, my deadly friend, you know, this is it. This is goodbye. I hope everyone's had a happy Halloween so far, and I hope you continue to do so. Thank you again, Tonya, for finding your time in your ever so busy and growing schedule.
Well, you did book me a year ago for this.
Well,
and
it just
happened to coincide with my film shoot, right? So
yeah.
It's a good thing I agreed last year. Boom. Because it benefits me again. And I'm also glad that you recognize that of the two of us, I am the deadly friend in this relationship.
Definitely.
But that means I have back, Daniel.
You are definitely the better looking one, and also a little colder and harder on the inside than myself, I think.
Yeah, well. Definitely that.
And definitely stronger as well by a mile, I think, too. But thank you. This has been brilliant. This has been a lot of fun. And yeah, we will see you very soon. I'm sure we'll do something, whatever it may be. I'm happy for more of your suggestions and rediscovering old films that you were like, yeah, these are great. And then
So spoiled? The last few films the last few topics we've discussed, we had, you know, The Crow, we're talking about that, Byzantium, Only Lovers Left Alive, Charlotte's Web, and now
Batman Returns. Yeah, all of the,
oh,
and
yes.
And our Pam Grier double bill as well, some excellent stuff. So yeah, so we definitely had to hit a clunker. It was going to happen. Statistically, it was just going to happen. But thank you again, and thank you everyone again for listening. Bye.